The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable John W. Turner presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to offer the apologies of the court for being a little bit late in starting the second argument this morning. We had some technical difficulties in our first one. We hope we've got them resolved so we don't have them in this one. And this is case number 421032. People v. Bledsoe. For the appellant, we have Daniel O'Brien appearing, and appearing for the appellee, Connor Getton. Mr. O'Brien, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court. I am Dan O'Brien with the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I'm representing Daniel Bledsoe. This case is about reasonable inferences, or put another way, just how attenuated an inference can be and still constitute proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Daniel Bledsoe was found guilty after a stipulated bench trial of felony resisting a peace officer, which includes the element that he knew that the person in question was a police officer. The evidence in trial consisted solely of a two-page stipulation, three photographs of Officer Clouston, and a gun that was taken from Daniel's person. The stipulation itself makes no mention of Daniel's knowledge that Clouston was a police officer, nor does it explicitly reference any facts that would directly suggest such knowledge. For example, it doesn't say that the officers were in uniform, that they were in a squad car, that there were sirens, emergency lights, that they identified themselves as police officers. And in this regard, it should be noted that the state's summary of the facts on the first page of their brief does not actually come from the stipulation that was the evidence at trial, but a suppression hearing that occurred weeks or months earlier and was not evidence of the trial. So any conclusion about Daniel's knowledge has to come from the little bit of information that we have in the stipulation itself. The closest thing to direct evidence that the state produces is a photograph of Officer Clouston, and particularly the photograph that shows him in police uniform and says that that's a fair and accurate photograph of him. That's a fair and accurate photograph of his injury. There's no indication of what time this picture was taken. There's no timestamp. There's no reference in the stipulation to this. So, and because it's presented as simply evidence of his injury and not of anything else, it doesn't follow from that Clouston is in the same clothes that he was in when the incident occurred. It could just as easily have been taken at another time after he got back to the station, hours later, even the next day on a different shift. The state insists that the statement that the officers were dispatched shows that they were in duty and on uniform, and that the cut is actively bleeding, and this shows that the photograph was taken immediately. But these proposals each call for inference upon inference, or put matters in evidence that aren't in evidence. The stipulation doesn't say anything about Clouston and Stone's duties, what their titles or responsibilities were. It doesn't say that they're patrol officers or what they were or what their particular responsibilities were that morning. The state assumes they're patrol officers. The state assumes that if they're patrol officers, they must be in uniform, but neither of these facts is actually provided us. The claim that the wound is actively bleeding is dubious. There's no blood evident in the photograph of the wound. The state calls it fresh and says that there's no signs of it healing, but both of these statements are conclusory. Both of them call for information that we're not privy to. Essentially, they're medical conclusions. We don't know what exactly happened to Officer Clouston's knee, what it looked like at the time, what it would look like a short while later or later that day or after being re-aggravated or after beginning to heal. So the conclusion that Clouston and Stone were in uniform rests on unstated premises, in short, assumptions. It doesn't follow from the information we have. And if they haven't shown that he's in uniform, they have failed to meet their burden because there's nothing else to suggest that that Bledsoe would have known that they were police officers. Again, there's no sirens, no car, no identification as police officers. So if you don't have them being in uniform, you have Daniel being grabbed from behind by two strangers telling him to stop at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Excellent argument, counsel. Do we have to ignore common sense? There's no indication of any witnesses, anyone stating that they were not in uniform. things of that nature. That may have been an issue had it been the case. Reasonable to argue, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is reasonable to again, perhaps assume that they may have been in uniform. But again, we have to look at the fact that it's the state's burden to produce the evidence, and they failed to produce any particular evidence demonstrating that he was in uniform at the time. It's not implausible that he was in uniform, but it hasn't been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, even if the court finds that it's a reasonable inference that the officers were in uniform, there's no evidence that Daniel observed the officers before they grabbed him. The cases cited in Daniel's brief where the courts did find proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the knowledge factor shows what a reasonable inference would look like in this case. People v. Sorrells, this court found it significant that Officer Brace was in his police uniform, driving a squad car, and acting in his official capacity, and that the defendant ran after being ordered to stop, which is different than the facts that we have here. And he stated that he ran because he was afraid he would be shot.
Well, the facts that we have here include the fact that the defendant did react to the police presence. I mean, he put his arms, I guess, close to his side. He felt his waistband. And then right after that, I believe it was Stone. Officer Stone called out 1032, which meant that there was probably a weapon on the defendant. So we have that to add to this. To the other pieces of evidence that you articulated in your opening remarks, the photos showing some sort of bleeding from a wound, the 1032, also Officer Clouston testified that he attempted, or they were attempting to handcuff the defendant as well. I mean, the totality of the circumstances certainly can point to sufficient evidence from which the judge could make that inference. Isn't that correct?
I think that that at a certain point, no doubt, Daniel Bledsoe became aware that that these were police officers. Obviously, after he was arrested, put in the squad car and so on. But I think that the question is whether or not the alleged conduct occurred before he knew this. So the behavior of grabbing his waistband, I think, is only really probative here if you start with the assumption that he saw the officers and this was a reaction to him. Other than that, we don't have a description of behavior here that is particularly or really at all unusual or suspicious. It is simply that's something that the officers appear to be suggesting that he was reacting to them, but that is not stated in the stipulation. So that's yet another inference or yet another step in this whole process that has to be drawn. As far as the 1032, I believe that occurred after they'd already grabbed him and he'd already pulled away from Officer Clouston. So I believe that it was to a degree after the fact. And it also, though, assumes that Daniel specifically would have known what 1032 meant. 1032 is a kind of a very, very vague general and to a lot of ears probably meaningless thing to say. So again, I think that there are certain inferences or assumptions that have to be made there to assume that actually contributed to his knowledge. And as far as the handcuffing, again, I believe that occurred after the conduct had already been committed. Two of the other cases that were cited in Daniel's brief, Wydra and Thigpen, again, include the same kind of element. So in Wydra, there were emergency lights, there were sirens activated, an officer announced himself as such. And the court noted that it was light enough for the defendant to see the uniforms and he'd reach for their holstered guns. So all of these things, again, combined to show that he actually knew that they were officers. And then in Thigpen, again, marked police car, sirens and emergency lights, the officer in question's in full uniform. He announced his office, stood face to face with the defendant. So the court found, quote, in paragraph 26 of Thigpen, Thigpen viewed Glowacki standing in front of him in his full police uniform. Again, all of these cases have this combination of facts that led directly to the conclusion that the defendant knew that he was dealing with police officers. again, the combination of that they announced themselves, that they were in uniform, that there were indications that he'd specifically seen them in uniform. We found no cases, and the state presented none, where knowledge was found based on mere speculation that the officers were in uniform, and speculation that he was that they were observed to be in uniform. It's true that mental states generally inferred from the surrounding circumstances, but the state still has to present sufficient evidence from which an inference of knowledge can be made. And that inference has to be based on established facts, not pyramid on intervening inferences. Courts have also phrased it that the state cannot leave to conjecture or assumption or even inference an essential element of the crime. It has to be proven. The state here presented no direct evidence that Daniel knew Clouston and Stone were police officers. They haven't even presented evidence from which that directly follows. There has to be this series of pyramiding inferences before one can come to that conclusion.
Well, in the stipulation, the court also heard a recitation of when the officers approached, Bledsoe moved his arms close to his side, felt for his waistband, and grabbed onto his waistband as he turned and walked away from the vehicle. The vehicle there obviously is the inference is the police vehicle, the vehicle that the two officer or that Officer Clouston arrived in when he responded to the 911 call for aid, a dispatch indicated that a caller had called in the fact that there was a verbal argument going on outside. So that's what he was responding to. And so it seems to me that when the court heard that, it certainly could infer that Bledsoe would have seen, I mean, why would he have moved his hands close to his body in order to and felt for his waistband if he didn't have a weapon, if he wasn't afraid of the two people who were dressed as the police coming after him?
Well, Judge, to address the first part of that.
Speculation. Pardon?
I'm sorry. Okay, to address the first part of that, I think that it is not clear that the officers arrived in the police car or that's the vehicle that they were referring to. Now, we all know more facts than are actually in evidence here because there are additional facts that were in the suppression hearing and so on. I think the overall facts make it slightly ambiguous whether the officers arrived in foot or on car from the first place that they arrived at. But and the other facts do make it clear that there were two vehicles in question, that Daniel and the alleged victim here were standing by a vehicle and that Daniel walked to another vehicle. Again, none of that actually is in evidence. I think that but that makes it very questionable what the vehicle is. It makes it sound like Daniel's actually just walking from the vehicle where he's standing arguing with his girlfriend to another vehicle. As far as the other aspect of him reaching for his waistband, putting his arms close to him, again, I think that in the absence of anything else, in the absence of an assumption that this was reactive behavior in the first place, you've described simply somebody hitching up his pants, somebody doing something that is perfectly ordinary and not necessarily suspicious, not without certain other assumptions. If you describe that without other attendant circumstances, that wouldn't automatically lead one to believe that suspicious behavior had occurred.
Mr. O'Brien, your client did stipulate to the exhibits, correct?
Yes.
And one of the exhibits is a picture of the officer standing in front of a marked police vehicle. Is that correct?
Correct.
Well, since you stipulated to the admission of that photograph, why isn't it a reasonable inference that vehicle is the vehicle that the officer arrived in? And as we've already, I think, agreed, it is a marked vehicle.
Judge, I think there's a couple of things there. First, that could just as easily, or perhaps the even more reasonable inference is that at the very least that was taken after they got back to the police station, after they'd actually gotten this arrest taken care of and got a camera.
I'm looking at the exhibit. It clearly was not taken at a police station.
Well, again, and I also don't think, though, that it matches the surroundings that were described. Daniel and again, the alleged victim here were described as standing in an open field. And there's clearly a building directly next to the vehicle in the picture. So I think that based on all that, it's reasonable to infer that the picture was in fact taken at another location.
Well, I think you got to live with your stipulation, just like the state has to live with theirs, which was a little lacking, we'll say, without any question. But to me, you stipulate to this photograph. Photograph shows the officer. He's got the pants leg rolled up, and then there's other photographs that show the injury. And he's in front of a vehicle that is marked. It seems to me that a reasonable fact finder could conclude that the officer was in uniform. The officer did arrive in a marked police vehicle, and it's not a very far leap to then suggest that defendant was aware of all that. Anyway, that's kind of what I think your hurdle is. I guess that's not really a question, but you can certainly address that if you'd like.
Judge, again, I just would note that I think that there's enough other factors there that make it very questionable, not necessarily entirely implausible that's the case, but that make other possibilities just as likely, and in some cases even more likely. Again, particularly the presence of a building there, and just the circumstances that would perhaps make it unlikely that Clouston and Stone would have been engaged in this picture taking process at the scene of the crime at the time of the arrest. So they're dealing with somebody who had a gun, who was being difficult and obstructing a police officer. There's no mention of any other officers there. It seems very reasonable to assume that this actually occurred later, again, at the very least after they got back to the police station.
Well, when it comes to inferences, isn't it most reasonable to infer that they took their picture once sort of clearing the scene with the defendant while they're both still there that night? Isn't that more plausible than it happening somewhere else?
I think anything's possible there. It's more a question of when they had the opportunity and when it occurred to them. It's just, again, it's certainly not implausible that they would have taken the picture when they got back to the station. But I would just come to the fact, again, that the state bears the burden of proof here. They have to put on the facts from which the evidence, from which, the inferences can be drawn. And they similarly bear the consequences of any omission of proof. So if nobody else has any further questions, thank you.
I don't see any questions, but you will have rebuttal. Mr. Ketton, you may proceed with your argument.
It please the court, counsel. My name is Connor Ketton, and I represent the state in this matter. As an initial matter, I would just like to point out that in reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence, the reviewing court must look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state and draw any reasonable inferences they're from the evidence in favor of the state. I think that, as we've gone over, the stipulated facts may have not been as robust as they could have been, but nonetheless, I believe that they are sufficient to prove that defendant knew that the police officers were police officers, that they were in uniform, and that he was aware of their being in uniform. The photos that were entered into evidence show that the wound is fresh, and this it's still kind of bleeding. It's wet. It's not dry. this supports the inference that the photographs were taken immediately after the incident in question, and that the police were in uniform at the time they encountered the defendant. And then as for the contention that defendant was not aware that they were police officers or did not see them, I think based on his behavior, it's a reasonable inference to conclude that he saw uniformed police officers. They approached him. He turned away from them. They commanded him to stop multiple times. And then they grabbed him.
So I got to stop you there. You say that they approached him and he turned away from the officers. That's not in the stipulation, is it?
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke, Your Honor.
Okay. And I do think, and counsel pointed this out, you got to be careful in your facts, and this is not to pick on you at all, but if you're giving facts that actually was facts that were uncovered at the suppression hearing, but not in the stipulation, though, you have to be careful not to include those just for future reference. And it brings us back to what I just said a minute ago. You seem to be arguing something that unfortunately is not in the stipulation. Unfortunately, from your standpoint, is that the officers, they very well may have approached him, then he turned away, but that is not in the stipulation, just to clarify. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize, Your Honor.
That's okay. And I know you didn't give the stipulation, but sure wouldn't have been very hard for the state to say that part of the stipulation is the patrol officers were in uniform and did arrive in a vehicle that was clearly marked. And since it was in writing and they had time to think about it, it just seems really strange that they failed to include that given what the charge was in this case. But I'm just rambling on because I don't expect you to respond to that. Please continue.
I just think that if you look at the totality of defendant's behavior, even after the initial walking away, he is grabbed, he continues to, he's grabbed and there's a struggle. He pulls away multiple times. I think that it's a reasonable inference to conclude that at some point during these multiple acts of resistance that he would have been aware, that he would have looked upon and been aware of the officers. And
did he continue to pull away after one of the officers said 1032, which means the presence of a gun?
Yeah, I think that certainly adds, makes it more likely that he should have been aware that they were officers.
Well, my question is, after he heard the expression 1032, did he continue to resist, or was the resistance already done at that time?
I believe that he continued to resist afterwards. I believe in the stipulated facts that it says that one of the officers attempted to reach for the gun and that he continued to pull away or struggle. I don't have the exact verbiage in front of me, and I apologize for that.
Okay, please continue.
That's about all I have. I believe that if those two inferences are sufficient to support the state's burden, and I would respectfully ask that this court affirm defendant's conviction, unless you have any more questions for me.
Justices, any questions before we turn it back to rebuttal? I see none. So is there any rebuttal, Mr. O'Brien?
Just briefly, Your Honor. First, again, I would note that, again, the state characterized the wound as fresh, and I believe here they described it as wet, whereas in the brief it had been described as actively bleeding. I think wet is probably a more accurate description of what was actually in the picture. And but again, I think that leads to slightly more ambiguity about when the photograph was actually taken. Some question about, was this actually immediately after they got back to the station or sometime later? I also just believe that the totality of this of the defendant's behavior, again, as referenced by the state there, I think that that when you break it down, that no aspect of the defendant's behavior is actually suspicious or in and of itself indicative of responding to the presence of a police officer. I think that certain inferences or assumptions have to be drawn to get to that point.
Well, but what about the time during this incident where the officers were trying to handcuff him and he pulled his hands away? He was actively resisting at that time. Isn't that correct? I mean, the stipulation indicates specifically after, I'm paraphrasing here, after he walked up to the vehicle, tried to open the door, and then it says Officer Clouston grabbed Blaisdell's arm, at which point Blaisdell tensed his muscles and tried to pull away. A brief struggle ensued, at which time Officer Stone grabbed him as well. During the struggle, Officer Stone said 10:32, meaning firearm. At that time, Officer Clouston tried to pull Blaisdell's arm upward and handcuff him. Blaisdell eventually was subdued and handcuffed. And then the stipulation goes on to talk about the recovery of the handgun.
Again, there, Judge, I believe that that it's ambiguous as to whether the struggle continued after that point. I think that the way that—
Excuse me, after what point?
After he said 10:32 and then tried to grab his arm and handcuff him. Because it says—
Eventually subdued. That certainly implies that it went on, that it didn't stop right there. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been the next sentence.
Correct. But again, Judge, I don't believe that it necessarily explicitly points to any conduct of his that occurred after that point. More importantly, though, I would just suggest that the 10:32 itself and possibly even the handcuffs aren't necessarily dispositive of him knowing anything. If, again, he's not aware what 10:32 means, and if he's not observing the officers, they may have grabbed his arm to handcuff him. As far as Daniel knows, he's still just being grabbed by two people from behind.
Who are trying to handcuff him? People on the street? Bystanders?
Well, again, I'm not necessarily sure that he would have been aware of that if he hadn't observed.
Sense, I guess, as Justice Kavanaugh mentioned earlier, I think we have to use common sense, but in assuming or thinking about what the trial court was able to discern and infer from the stipulation, and common sense is you don't necessarily have strangers on the street, panhandlers or anybody else try to handcuff somebody. I mean, they might try to subdue him in some way or take him to the ground, but not with handcuffs.
Right. Again, I think that an assumption is required regarding his knowledge or awareness of the fact that they were trying to handcuff him if, in fact, he didn't observe them. And I have nothing further in rebuttal if there's no further questions.
I see no further questions. Thanks to both of you for your arguments. The case is now submitted and the court stands in recess.